Hey, this is Jay Underwood, Johnny Storm, the Human Torch from the original Fantastic Four movie, and you're listening to Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. Flame on!
Welcome, one and all. This is Comic Book Central, and I'm your host, Joe Stuber. It is a cold, cold February here at the Lair, but things are heating up today as Fantastic Four February continues with the hothead himself, Johnny Storm, the Human Torch from the original Fantastic Four movie. Actor Jay Underwood will be joining us. Now, I hope you've been following along with Comic Book Central this month as we celebrate the 20th anniversary of the original unreleased Fantastic Four movie. We've been unraveling the mystery of this controversial film with stories from those who were on the set of the Roger Corman-produced low-budget take on Marvel's First Family. We sat a stretch with Alex Hyde-White, who played the FF's fearless leader, Reed Richards. We caught sight of Rebecca Staub, the invisible woman, Sue Storm. And today, it's time for Rebecca's on-screen sibling, Jay Underwood. Now, as some of you listeners know, I can also be heard talking about Indiana Jones comic books with my podcasting partner, Keith Voss, over at the IndieCast. That would be the number one Indiana Jones podcast in the world, hosted by that awesome Aussie, the Thunder from Down Under, Ed Disco Dollister. Now, the reason I bring up the IndieCast, in addition to the fact that it is a primo podcast, is that my guest today, Jay Underwood, appeared in three episodes of the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles, where he portrayed a young Ernest Hemingway. If you haven't seen those episodes, by the way, check them out on Netflix. They are terrific. Well, Jay and I talked about his time on the Young Indie television series, and you can check out that part of the discussion over at theindiecast.com. It's episode 176. Hey, now that I'm thinking about it, I think this is our first IndieCast Comic Book Central crossover. It's kind of like the old $6 Million Man Bionic Woman crossovers that they used to have. Although, again, now that I'm thinking about it, that would probably make me the Bionic Woman in this analogy. Oh, well, over on the IndieCast, Jay talks about some of his earlier acting roles, including his incredible portrayal of a teen with autism in The Boy Who Could Fly and the legendary Sonny Bono in the Sonny and Cher story. So check that out. It's one of my favorite interviews because Jay has such a high energy level, and he really makes you feel as if you're right on the set of the Young Indie production. Great stories. He does the same thing with the Fantastic Four. This is really a treat today. So make sure you check out Jay's Young Indie stories over at theindiecast.com, episode 176. And then Jay's going to join me in the lair in just a moment to talk about the Fantastic Four. Jay Underwood made a name for himself as a teen actor in the 80s, taking on a wide variety of roles, including several high-profile sci-fi and fantasy projects. In The Boy Who Could Fly, Jay took on the role of Eric, a quiet boy with a very special gift. And in Disney's Not Quite Human trilogy, he portrayed an android, Chip Carson, a role Jay patterned after Jeff Bridges' performance in Starman. He also crossed paths with Sean Patrick Flannery's Indiana Jones in the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles. As a young Ernest Hemingway, Jay fought alongside Indy in the war and fought Indy himself for the affections of a young lady. He also solved a mystery with our favorite archaeologist and had time to catch a Broadway show. It was around this time that Jay got the call from his agent. Marvel Comics' The Fantastic Four was set to leap from the page to the screen, and the producers needed a real-life Johnny Storm. It was time for Jay to flame on and bring his energetic personality to the Human Torch. Well, you might remember our guest today from his roles in such films as The Boy Who Could Fly, the Not Quite Human trilogy, Uncle Buck, and he also played Sonny Bono in the Sonny and Cher story.
That's right.
He's also appeared in a number of TV shows, including, 21 Jump Street, Star Trek Voyager, X-Files, The Young Indiana Jones Chronicles, The Adventures of Superboy, and, of course, he played the hot-headed Johnny Storm in the original Fantastic Four movie. Welcome to the show, Jay Underwood.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
Wow, that is quite a list, but obviously to build up that kind of career, you started acting at a pretty young age. Do you recall your first acting gig?
Let's see. Yeah, if you want to get, go way back, let's see, I think performing for the neighborhood kids, I used to do magic shows and puppet shows, and I'd set up chairs and things and do them on my front porch. So that's going way back. And then,
did you charge for those?
No, they were free. No, okay. you were happy to have it.
I didn't know if that was your first paid gig or not. So.
I'm sure I was thinking it. No, well, here, the funny story about that. I got into theater, and I did a lot of theater around the Bay Area and took a lot of kids' classes where I grew up in Hayward, California. And then I ended up going to a performing arts high school in Minneapolis called the Children's Theater Company. And while I was there, all the kids in the theater had agents because they do a lot of commercials and industrial films and that sort of thing there. And I thought, well, shucks, I want to make some money. And so my first paid gig was, what was it? It was a radio spot for Swiss Miss Chocolate. And all I had to do was say the word sure. And I had to go, sure. And they paid me $240. And I thought, I am having the last laugh on this one.
You thought, sure.
That was that for a 15-year-old kid. That was like, wow, you've got to be kidding me. You'll pay me to do this stuff?
Isn't that great?
So there you go.
So very cool. Hey, do you want to mind talking comic books for a little bit?
No, yeah, let's talk comic books.
One of your earlier comic book appearances, The Adventures of Superboy, season 4 episode. You played Mike Walker, also known as
Kryptonite Kid.
What's the story of Mike Walker? What's his deal?
You know, here's the thing. What's the story of me playing all these kinds of parts? You know, that's what I think is funny.
It's a pretty good variety.
When you go back and I look at my early career especially, I got all of these kind of either superhero or robot, Kryptonite
Science fiction,
Kid, voice
fantasy
fly,
genre.
Yeah. Just these crazy kind of parts, Human Torch. I don't know what it is about that. But in any case, that was just a deal where, gosh, I'm trying to think. I don't even remember if I auditioned for it, if it was something they just even offered to me or what. But we got the script for the Kryptonite Kid, and they were filming. They filmed down in Orlando at Universal Studios in Orlando. And so I got to go down there and play this. You know what was cool about that was he's like the good scientist kid turned bad. He gets infected with the kryptonite and then he's out there wreaking havoc. And so whenever I got the chance to play, more of an offbeat character or even the bad guy, in an episode of anything, I would take it because traditionally when you look at my stuff, I'm cast as the all-American nice guy next door, And so when that was, I think the fun part of that was just getting to eat the scenery, basically, When I got down there and they showed me what the wardrobe was going to be like and, the leather jacket and crazy hair and, motorcycle boots and ripped jeans or whatever it was like, yeah, this is fun.
Well, and you kind of get to play like Rock Band on these power wires, power lines.
Like doing the wires like they were guitar exactly.
Yeah, it's just, and a lot of actors say that when they get a chance to play the villain, you can go over the top because the hero's got to be the one that always has to bring it down to earth. And yeah, you can get crazy. You think about like villains like the Joker and different things like that. And boy, as an actor, that's got to be just a wide open array of choices there.
Exactly. Again, it's just. I've enjoyed playing the kind of larger than life characters that I have because, again, I think in my mind anyway, that's kind of the point, and I know we'll transition into this to talk about the Fantastic Four, but when you're playing these kind of comic book characters, I mean, golly, comic books are larger than life. I mean, are they not, not to say that you want it to come off like some kind of joke or something. But even when and I would often compare the Fantastic Four movie we did with in terms of its own style with the old Batman TV series, the color version there where everything was a little over the top, when they're hitting people pow and slap and whatever.
And truly a comic book come to life.
Exactly. Exactly. In my mind, that would be more of the point, you know? And I think there's been a trend that we've seen where now they want these, the latest comic book movies are more true to life, kind of sometimes even, you know, and saying, well, we're going to change the costume, we're going to change the look from the original comic and kind of make it this updated modern version. And in some cases, I think it comes off and it's fine. And in other cases, you go, oh, yeah, but it's not really the comic book, you know?
Right. Well, you mentioned the Fantastic Four. You didn't get to play the bad guy in that one, but you got to play the good guy. You got to play Johnny Storm, a.k.a. the Human Torch.
The Human Torch.
Yeah, we talked with Alex Hyde-White. We talked to Rebecca Staub about this. Again, it's this film, and we talked about it in our other interviews. It's this film that probably got a lot more attention not being released than it ever got that it ever would have gotten being released. What are your memories of coming into this role? Were you approached by somebody? Did an agent bring it to you? Had you heard about the casting?
Sure. First of all, I would say you're absolutely correct. The whole cast was together recently. Actually, we were together about 2 years ago at a comic convention we did in St. Louis. And we talked about it then. And I recently, there's a new documentary being made called Doomed that hopefully may even premiere. We would love to see it premiere at someplace like Comic-Con next go round. But in any case, I did some interviews for that just, a couple of months ago, I think it was. And we laugh and joke about the fact that this thing just will not die. I mean, it has a life that of its own that just continues to continue. Right. You know, we think, and again, you're absolutely right in that had this movie come out, and I don't think any of us thought that it would be some huge blockbuster. We were hoping that it might come out and that it might be somewhat warmly received by the comic community for what it was, made on the budget that it was. But it would have, you know, gone bye-bye at some point, and that would have been that. But man, this thing just continues to have life, and a bigger life, you're right, than it ever would have had, you know, if it did not have the backstory to go with it, which I'm sure we'll get into here. But for me, coming into it was, no, it just came through my agent. It was just a normal audition like any other. My agent called me up. Actually, it was my manager at the time, and he said, and he was all excited. And he goes, man, I got you an audition for the Fantastic Four movie. And I was like, oh, that's cool. And he goes, you know the Fantastic Four, right? And I go, yeah, I think they're a comic book, right? And he goes, well, yeah, they're like, you know, one of Marvel's, you know, most awesome, you know, comic books. And I'll be
your
honest.
Your agent was a comic fan.
Exactly. And I'll be honest with you here on Comic Book Central that at the time I was not. I was not like a huge comic book aficionado. Growing up, I remember reading, I think my comics were Mad. I used to love Mad Magazine, which I don't know if you consider it a true comic, not like, you know, a superhero comic book, and Cracked. And I remember reading like the Archie Jughead, you know, comics and stuff. But I just had never, for whatever reason, gotten into, like, say, the Marvel comics. And so so he's all just – he's flipping out that he got me this audition. I'm like, yeah, that's cool, man. That's, he's like, no, you don't get it. You don't get
you're
it.
You're just not returning the energy. Yeah, you're not giving him the energy he wanted.
Yeah, that's it. And I read it. And my father-in-law – I'm married at the time. My father-in-law was a huge comic book fan. So he was jumping off the walls too knowing that I had this audition. So he's sending me out comic books, you know, Fantastic Four comic books so I can read them and, you know, get some idea what's going on here.
Which
and I read the script.
Is he sending you? Is he sending you some of the early, like, 1960s Stan Lee, Jack Kirby kind of stuff?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. In fact, I don't know what the episode – what the number is on it, the – one specific one that he sent me. But yeah, he started rounding up all kinds of, well, once he knew I got the part, then he started keeping his eye out for all the little trinkets and, you know, Johnny Storm calls and this and that and everything else. But so I read the script and you know, was looking at some of the magazines and went in there and did this audition. Now, of course, the other part of the story is that, well, who's making this? You know, is it Universal? Is it Paramount? Is it, you know, what a studio is behind this? Well, no, it's not. Well, it's a studio, but it's just not one of the major ones. And I wasn't overly familiar with Roger Corman either. I knew who he was, and I'd heard of him, and knew that he was the king of B movies. And so I go to Roger Corman's office building. And it's you know, kind of ragtag and, you know, whatever. And go in there and do the audition. And usually you do an audition in, you know, for a movie. Then you'll have a callback and you might have another callback and, you know, on down the line. I think, I don't know, a week or so later, I got the call. You got the part. You're Johnny Storm. And I was like, cool. And my manager's like, no, that's awesome. You don't get it. You're still not getting it. No, I said, no, that's great. That's great. That's great. I'm excited. And so we went into production pretty quickly. And the first thing that they had to have me do was, well, and they asked me this in the audition. They go, would you be willing to dye your hair? Because I have just kind of basic light brown kind of colored hair. And I said, well, yeah, absolutely. And I knew at that point, obviously, that Johnny Storm was blonde in the comic book. So they had me go and get my hair peroxide, basically. So I go to the fellow at the time that used to cut my hair and said, you know, we need to dye it blonde because I'm playing Johnny Storm in the Fantastic Four. And he goes, cool, let's do it, you know. And they puts this peroxide stuff in my hair. And I don't know, like 15 minutes go by, and I'm like, man, my head is feeling kind of funny. You know, it's kind of tingling here. And he goes, oh, well, okay, that's, you know, we'll keep an eye on things there. Another 5 minutes go by, and now it's starting to get warm, almost hot. And another 5 minutes go by, and it starts to burn. And the fella that's cutting my hair, I'm like, okay, man, you got to get this out. I'm almost crying because it hurts so bad. And he goes, get over to the sink. And he starts washing it out. And we look in the mirror, and it's orange. I mean, it's not even close to blonde yet, you know.
This is an episode of the Brady Bunch. I think I saw this one.
It is, isn't it? I love the Brady Bunch.
Was it Greg Brady? So
that's exactly.
His hair.
That's it.
Oh.
From the hair product that one of the kids was selling, right? Something like
yes.
that. So anyway, we finally figured out a way. So he had to highlight the rest of my head, you know, to get it blonde. And so we finally got it blonde and got it looking like Johnny Storm, and so we could start filming.
You guys, flame on, right?
Flame on, man. You know what it was? It was the scene out of it was the same deal as Spike Lee when he did wasn't it Malcolm X? I want to say it was Malcolm X, and there's a scene in the beginning where his character, same thing, he's getting his hair dyed or peroxide, and he starts freaking out because it burns his scalp, and he's like jumping up and down while they're washing it out. And I felt the same way. Oh, man.
Well, you know, we mentioned Flame On. Not too many, to my, you know, I was thinking about this before our interview. Not too many superheroes have specific catchphrases. Obviously, in Fantastic Four, you've got the Thing. It's Clobber and Time.
Clobber and Time.
But you got Johnny Storm's catchphrase. What was it like to say that for the first time? Did you kind of read the comics? Obviously, it's popping up in the comics all over the place.
Oh, yeah. You know what? Again, it's, and this is maybe why some of these parts that we've talked about, why I get kind of these parts, because I think I just kind of go for it. You know, you just realize again that some of these things are just, it's over the top. I mean, it's not reality, you know, you're not playing, you know, reality. And so, you know, for somebody that goes flame on, you know, and ignites, you just have to go for it. And I think that's what I had so much fun with, was just going for it. And
it's not a subtle read.
What's that?
It's not a subtle read.
No, it's not. Exactly. You know, you do that, it's just going to,
you can't underplay Flame On.
And of course, I'm looking in the comic too for opposes and things, because that was the other thing that Ole talked me through, was, you know, and you're going to be throwing fireballs too and stuff like that. And so you need to kind of come up with a signature deal that's true to the comic for how you. I'm sitting here in the office, by the way. You can't see it, but I'm doing it as I'm talking to you. I'm throwing flame balls. So, nice. Yeah, so you can, you know, have a certain style to it and again, be true to the comic. And I think that was, you know, going back to the Roger Corman 9 yards and the fact that when we started this movie, we all understood really quickly what it was about and what it was entailing in terms of it being a low budget film and the fact that Roger Corman was doing it. And nobody at the time really, we didn't know any of the kind of behind the scenes story that we'll talk about here in a minute, I'm sure. To us, it was just Roger Corman. He's making this movie. And for Roger, it was actually a fairly large budget. I'm trying to remember, was we were talking about this when we were filming the documentary recently. But, you know, I think it was, if I remember right, it was in the kind of $1 million range or just slightly under, or $800,000 or something like that.
That's what I was kind of wondering, too, because I think, if I'm not mistaken, an episode of the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles was $1 million.
Well, yeah, exactly. Or around
it. So it's like you've. What so you did in Young Indiana, movie. You're doing a feature film, exactly, with
a
ton of special effects,
comic.
With guys throwing flames and stretching and yeah.
Well, and so yeah. I don't know that it ever crossed any of our minds, like, okay, what's wrong with this picture? You know, we knew that it was low budget, and why he was doing it versus a big studio, we didn't know. And the other thing you have to remember was at the time, comic book movies were not a proven commodity. You did have Superman that had come out and obviously had some success. And I'm trying to remember, I think...
Basically, it was Superman and Batman.
Had Batman come out?
Yeah, basically, it was Superman and Batman.
Superman and Batman.
And Marvel Comics were just struggling at that point.
Were struggling, exactly. And again, nobody, even with the success of those two, it wasn't like every studio was clamoring for the next comic book, you know, property kind of deal. And so I think, if you read
Michael Uslan's book, The Boy Who Loved Batman... Uh-huh. It was a 10-year battle just to get Batman. Even with the success of Superman, it was a 10-year battle just to get Batman on.
There you go.
You're absolutely right. It was comic book movies where it's not like it was today.
No, not at all. So I don't think in that sense it really surprised any of us. Like, gosh, why isn't one of the big studios doing this? You know, we knew what we were up against at the same time, and that's where to the director Oli's credit. He got us all together, and he basically said, because this was his first kind of big directing, well, first feature film directing. He had done music videos. He had written some other scripts that had been produced as feature films, and he got us all together as a cast, and he said, okay, gang, so here's the deal. We know that we're fighting an uphill battle because we don't have the money that you would normally need for all the special effects that would go into a movie like this for the Fantastic Four. So he said, here's what I want our focus to be. I want our focus to be on the script and on the story and on your characters. You guys do the best job you can, and you just make those characters true to the comic book. We're going to keep the story as true to the comic book as we can and as solid as we can, and we'll do our best with the rest, you know, in terms of dealing with the special effects end of things. And I think then again, what Oli kind of went for was something that was going to be a more stylized kind of comic version in the vein of, I used this earlier, the Batman television series, mm-hmm. where it wasn't meant to be, you know, more reality based and or modernized or whatnot. And, you know, he did that sometimes with his camera angles, too, you know, and just, you know, maybe the camera's low and kind of cocked kind of funny at a weird angle and just
yeah, you had that Batman, that 45-degree
exactly.
villain's
That's
lair
it.
Angle. Right.
Yeah, just a little more stylized, you know, because, again, we knew that we weren't going to have all the money that you would need to have just most, you know, greatest awesome effects. And we all were on board and we all said, yes, let's do it. And so you had this cast that, you know, I mentioned this with Young Indy, and it was really true. In this respect as well, that, boy, we just developed kind of a really great camaraderie right at the beginning for all of us, including Joseph Culp, who played Dr. Doom. He's one of the principal cast there as well. And Michael Bailey Smith, who played Thing out of the costume, and then Carl Ciafalo, I think, who played him in the costume. And we just became very close. And what was interesting was, as we were filming, because it was a pretty short filming schedule, I think it was like somewhere in the 4 to 6 week range, something like that.
Which is almost nothing.
Which is, yeah. I mean, that's nothing for a feature without, you know, special
right.
effects.
Right.
Exactly. We would talk about this, and we realized very fast that word was already out to the comic community that this movie was being made. And so we were already getting calls about comic conventions and participating in them. There was a magazine, I don't know if it's even still going on at the time, called Film Threat. And Film Threat did this big, planned to put us on the cover. And they came out to the set and spent a couple days on the set and did all these interviews with everybody. And so we already had basically a built-in audience, and we knew it. And again, we also knew what we were up against. So we thought, okay, this now has the propensity to do good for all of us. that we were all actors that had done a certain amount of work and had been around Hollywood for a certain amount of time. But none of us had, you know, escalated up into, you know, star status or A-list status or what have you. And but we all thought, you know, if we can do a good job at this movie and if it comes out and if it's just halfway decent in the comic community, like I said, kind of gives it a thumbs up or, a, you know, a warm embrace, then it really could do good for all of our careers as well, including Oli, the director. And so we really had that going on in the back of our minds, you know, and really, again, wanting to work hard and working under some really crazy conditions, because Roger Corman had he had this studio in Venice that and this isn't saying anything that probably Roger wouldn't admit to himself, that basically should have been condemned, this building. It was just disgusting. And there was always ant problems and mice problems and rat problems and this, that, and the other. And
this
and
is not the Paramount lot, correct?
This is not the Paramount lot. We do not have star wagons and mobile homes for dressing rooms.
Giant trailer out there. Yeah, right.
Man, none of that stuff. And yet we all said, hey, doesn't matter. We're going to stick together. We're all in this together. We're going to do our best. We're going to have fun. Oli was the leader. He was great with just kind of keeping the morale high, you know, amongst the people, and we'll see what we come up with.
Do you think those difficulties kind of brought you closer together as a cast and then maybe affected your performance to draw you close together? Because that's kind of what the Fantastic Four do. They're dealing with different stuff. They're fighting all the time, and then they come together at the end, you know?
And you know, I don't know if I really ever thought of that, at least while we were filming it, but you're absolutely right, Joe. That most certainly had a profound effect on just even in our relationships on screen, because Alex was kind of the leader of our little band, you know? He just kind of became that. I mean, in terms of just as you know, off camera, us hanging out or doing whatever. And Rebecca and I fell into a very comfortable brother-sister kind of relationship. I used to bring games. We were playing at the studio, and I'd bring games, and she'd bring games, and we just play games when we weren't filming and stuff like that. You know, just total brother-sister kind of stuff. And so everybody just you know, meshed. Of course, Joe Culp as Doom wasn't, you know, he's not like the Sean Penn actor where he's got to get into his character and, you know, and you know, hate us the whole time.
He didn't march around in costume on set.
March around in costume. Maybe only in West Hollywood or
Doom Venice, says, put that game down now.
know.
he didn't parade around.
No, okay. Unless he did at home when nobody was looking or something, you
cape.
Know, take the green cape home. But yeah, it was. And I think, I hope, you know, that all that translated to the screen.
Well, I think when you look at it too, and in watching it, I've seen it a ton
I was
of times.
Ask you, yeah.
Yeah, I've seen it a bunch of times. I have my beloved bootleg DVD copy,
sure,
that I kind of Mystery
yep.
Science Theater over the years with it.
Yep.
But it's fun. I said that there's definitely a charm to it, and there's stuff in there. You've got the all hands in scene. You've got the fantastic car. I think the thing. Animatronic face works. You've got the classic costumes. You've got the relationship between the characters. I think the elements are there. A very cool kind of mole man takeoff with the jeweler.
Yeah.
So you've got a lot of different elements there. Were you, how disappointed were you when you first realized, oh, this isn't going to be seen?
Well, yeah. That was a huge bummer. Now, really quick, you mentioned the costumes too. This is where it got kind of comical. And if you go back and watch the film again, at times, you know, they're working with what they can budget wise. And there are times where you see the costumes and we have this blue spandex and whatnot, but everything's just slightly off.
Yeah.
Like the numbers, they're hand sewn on, you know, and sometimes the number is kind of below our little white belt. And
tucked
sometimes
in.
It's above it, you know,
it's tucked in. Well, but Rebecca even mentioned that. She said, well, you know, in the scene, Sue puts the costumes together kind of quickly.
Right.
And it's
exactly.
Like, here's your costume. And they're like, what's this? So there is an element that is addressed in the film.
Exactly.
In all fairness. But yeah, I do love that about where the numbers are kind of.
I love that Rebecca came up with this. I think that's totally cool and appropriate. Yeah.
Seems like something she would do even in character.
Totally.
It's like, hey, I made costumes, guys.
Made costumes.
Let's go fight crime.
So yes, so to talk about what happened, we finished filming the movie, and we're just kind of hanging out, waiting. You know, waiting. But you know, as actors, you're back to, you know, getting the next job kind of thing and auditioning. But they finally came around, and Oli had talked about how the film was finished. In fact, they even went back and he got some of the special effects kind of bolstered up a bit to try to even make them a little bit better than they were. And I hope you have the opportunity to talk to Oli, because he's got just some great stories about this. When I was sitting there, I watched his interview when we were doing the Doom documentary a couple of months ago, and I was fascinated because he talks about things I had forgotten about or didn't know about just the post-production schedule. And how that all worked. And so in any case, from an actor's point of view, though, we were told that the film was going to premiere in January 94, made it in 93 in the fall. And it was going to have a premiere. They were starting to plan a premiere. The premiere was going to be at the Mall of America in Minneapolis. They had all these tie-ins to, Ronald McDonald House was a charity that they were bringing on board to help kids. And on top of it, comic book conventions were calling and wanting to book us and do more interviews and go to this convention and that convention and what have you. And so we all start getting excited. You know, this is really happening. This is really happening. This is great.
Now this is the excitement your manager wanted.
Yes, exactly.
We're there.
That's it. I'm totally, we're all keyed up for it. Just
flame on, baby.
Ready, flame on. Bring it on. Let's go. Let's have fun. And then I don't remember when I got the call. I believe it was in December. It might have been January, but I'm thinking December. And I don't remember who called me. I don't remember. I think it was Oli that was calling all of us. And he said, man, you're not going to believe this. The movie's gone. Like, God, what are you talking? Like, what's it got, like, burned? Some accident or something? He goes, no, they shelved it. They shelved it. They've shelved it, and it's never going to see the light of day. And he was, you could tell he was upset. And like, Oli, what are you talking about? He goes, man, it was all some kind of ploy. It was all some backroom deals and stuff going on. But basically, the movie is not going to come out because they want to, sell the rights to a bigger studio so that they can make it as a big studio movie, and they don't want this one anywhere near that one or messing it up or whatever, and so it's just gone. And we were all just shocked. I mean, just shocked. And that's all that happened. I mean, you know, everything was just gone. The premiere was gone, you know. There was just nothing, no movie. And it was interesting because at that point, over the next year, is when you started trying to kind of piece together the puzzle here as to what happened, what was going on. And then since then, now, because it's been, well, that was 94, and here we are, and, you know, 20 years later, the puzzle pieces are still being fit together. And I don't think that we have most of them, but maybe not all of them still. And so over the next year, what I came to understand was that you had this fella, Bernd Eichinger, who had the rights to the Fantastic Four and had a film company and whatnot. And part of his deal was he would lose the rights to the movie if he had not gone into production. Once the movie gets pulled and shelved, then Bernd can turn around and sells the rights to 20th Century Fox, who buy it specifically, I believe, for Chris Columbus to be a part of. And so he does that, and that's where it goes, you know. At that point, we all kind of thought, well, so why did we film the whole movie? Because other people had commented that when you have there have been other situations like that in the past with movie rights and whatnot, where productions have gone into production and then they just pull the plug.
Yeah, just shoot a few scenes or shoot half the movie.
Exactly. And then, you went into production, that we've satisfied our contract to keep the rights, et cetera. Right. Well, Oli's take on that is that he said, I think Bernd wanted a finished product. He wanted a finished movie because if it didn't work out to actually get rid of the rights and sell them somewhere else, he still wanted to have a finished product that he could try to make his money back on, you know?
Right.
So we did. We finished the film and whatnot. But then once he knew that he could sell the rights, and I think quickly did, then that was that. then the movie just vanished. It was just gone. Roger Corman doesn't own it. He was just basically hired to make the film, and which he did. The producer that Corman had on it, Steve, he believed that it was going to show up in theaters, or if not theaters, DVD or whatever, you know.
Right. Because Captain America had done that. They had done a Captain America movie.
Exactly.
Yeah, it went straight to video. Yeah.
Sure. So what Roger actually knew, I think, is a bit of a mystery.
Well, what's classic about this is there are just so many stories and so many, this person said this and what did they know and when did they know it and all these different things. But it's really taken on a life of its own when it probably would have just gone straight to the old VHS bins and never been talked about ever again.
Some of the key moments, you know, so that first year, there were a couple of magazines that wanted to do stories. I forget which one it was. It was one of the film, you know, a popular, you know, magazine did a little article on it as to kind of what happened to it. Then, let's see, this would have been about 10 years ago, I want to say. About 10 years ago, a magazine called Los Angeles Magazine decided there was an author there, a writer there, and he wanted to do a more in-depth investigation and see if he could put in, you know, all the pieces and fit them together. And so he got some really good interviews, and we did a big photo shoot for that one, which was really cool. So we all got together and did a photo shoot with Roger Corman. It was one of the more in-depth ones because he interviewed Roger. He also interviewed, I think he heads Marvel now, and he was heading Marvel at the time of this interview, and he interviewed him. And he made some really wacko comments about the movie, and basically saying he said in the interview, and we all believe that he's joking, you know. But he talked about how they got rid of the negative, they burned it or trashed it or something, that they destroyed the negative.
Oh, Avi Arad.
Yes, that's it.
Yeah, Avi Arad had said that was a big thing, was that he went in. I don't know if he said it or if somebody had said it about him, but that he had gone in, paid Corman, or was it Oli, maybe, and bought up all the negatives and burned them all.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's not true?
Well, none of us think so. That's again, what was reported, right?
Hopefully he didn't, because maybe we could get a DVD release here. Yeah.
I think it's in a vault somewhere.
How cool of an extra would that be?
What's that?
How cool of a DVD extra would that be, or Blu-ray extra?
And that's kind of the point of the documentary and Doom too. I mean, we would love to see that happen. And in all of our minds, nobody can imagine that it would detract in any way from the franchise that they've got going on, or even the new Fantastic Four movie that they're working on. You know, everybody thinks, gosh, it would just be a hoot, and if anything, would just be an extra bonus, you know, to put it on some kind of DVD deal. But that was probably one of the more comprehensive articles. And then, of course, more recently, as I've mentioned a couple of times, we all got together to be a part of this documentary called Doomed, which we hope will kind of be the last. And you're right, it's to commemorate the 20 years that it's been since the movie didn't get released. And maybe that'll be one of the last pieces of the puzzle. They're hoping to get, you know, they put in calls to everybody for interviews, and that's really what's gonna make that or really kind of complete it, would be if people like Avi would give an interview, you know, hopefully truthful and you know, actually talk about some of these things that kind of went on. I mentioned too that we all got together as a cast. It was about two summers ago in St. Louis for a convention called Contamination, which was a comic and pop culture convention. And here, I'll tie the two together for you. Guess who was at that one? But Sean Patrick Flannery was there at the convention promoting, what's the series of movies he's done?
Boondock Saints.
Yes, Boondock Saints. That's it. So he was there with them. And he and I hadn't seen each other since working on Young Indy, which was, 20 years ago? Something
right before, it should be like 21, 22.
Yeah, 21 years ago, exactly. And so we had a kind of a fun little reunion there where we got to see each other and just kind of catch up for a minute. But at that convention, all the cast was there. Oli flew in, and we talked about did a Q&A, you know, with the folks there, just like we're doing now, just about the movie and what happened with it
Is that the first time you had seen it completely?
No, because Oli had his own copy of it, and he was kind enough to to make sure that we all had copies of it, kind of thing.
But that was the first time you'd seen it with an audience, though, right?
Yes. Yeah.
What do you think about that experience and the film itself?
It was great, and I think for the most part, the people there that were in the audience, were people that had more than likely already seen it, like you said, on bootleg copies or what have you. And I think so for the most part, the people that were there were enthusiastic about it. Now, here's what's funny. I mean, I've read things too, you can go on the internet and read all kinds of, people's opinions and whatnot about it. And I've seen all the bad ones too. And all the people that just rake it over the coals and just talk about it being over the top and Jay Underwood couldn't act his way out of paper bag and, all this,
your performance is a bit manic.
Johnny Storm and oh my word. Yeah. And so you just gotta go, you just have to laugh. I mean, you just have to have a sense of humor. And again, I would say what I said before, which is for what we had to work with money-wise and for just kind of the situation at hand, I know this. We all put our heart and souls into making that and doing the best that we could. And so nobody treated it like, oh, this is just some stupid low-budget thing and I can just kind of phone this one in or I don't really have to commit to it or I really don't have to do a good job. You may not like my performance. You may not like the movie, but again, it was made with heart. Everybody's hearts, from the cast and Oli being in on it, we cared about what we were doing and we really wanted it to be good and to do the best we could under the circumstances. So for that, I'm incredibly proud about it. I really am. I love talking about it. That's why, like you said, 20 years later, I still enjoy talking about it. And, here's one of the other little funny things is after we made the film and it didn't come out, I put it on my resume. And so, oh boy, when I would go to interviews for other film and TV roles and whatnot, and sometimes you're sitting there with the director or the producer, and they look at your resume while you're sitting in the room with them, and they kind of scan it and go through, and they inevitably, the one job that I had on there that they just unanimously would want to talk about was the Fantastic Four. I had more, got more mileage out of just talking about that because, again, even Hollywood community knew about the movie and knew that it was being made, that Roger was doing it and blah, blah, blah. They would scan the resume and they go, oh, Fantastic Four, tell me about that because that never came out, right? Exactly,
So, your agent was right.
Yeah.
All those years ago, your agent was right for you to get excited about it.
No
and
kidding.
Hey, you even got the stamp of approval from Stan the Man Lee. Interview with him, he said, it was never intended to be seen. That's what he said, but he said the actors acted their hearts out. He said they did a great job considering there was little or no budget. Considering what they spent on it, they did a great job. They did their best. So the guy that created the Fantastic Four, he gives you a stamp of approval for your performance.
There you go.
So.
And we actually had Stan Lee on our movie set, too. He showed up one day.
Did you get to meet him and work with him?
Yeah, I did.
Did you get some pointers?
We were filming the scene going into the giant office building when they bring the diamond into the office building, and he showed up. And I don't remember if Oli had – I think he had previously met Stan and knew him, and then he and Stan actually maintained a relationship afterwards, and they even went and pitched some different things together. And again, Oli could tell you more about that. But so Stan came on the set, and when we were just together recently, a couple of months ago, Oli and I – for the documentary, I asked him, I said, now, because Stan always makes these little cameos in the other films that he's done, I said, I want to say, Oli, that he made a cameo in this one, that you put him in the crowd, the office scene when they're carrying the diamond. And Oli goes, I may have. He goes, I'm going to have to go back and watch that again.
Is that the first Stan Lee cameo?
It could be, but then
breaking news right here.
Who knows if my memory, this is 20 years ago. You know how sometimes
it's a great story.
Create memories never really happen.
It just adds to the legend of the movie, if nothing
else. Exactly. There you go.
Did you see, we mentioned briefly the other movies. Did you see the two Fantastic Four movies? The Fantastic Four and Rise of the Silver Surfer?
I didn't see the Silver Surfer. I saw the first one. And, just as a movie, I enjoyed it just fine, and I didn't have any ill, feelings towards it or anything like that. That would be ridiculous. I thought it was a totally different movie than what we made. Well, obviously in terms of the budget, but even in terms of just the style and the story, you know, because they did. It didn't look like the comic book, you know, it didn't have the same kind of costumes as the comic book, and you know, things were modernized and updated and whatnot. And that's where, again, we tried to just kind of keep ours in a timeless vein, you know, where you wouldn't even necessarily know the time period that it was. And we really tried to replicate the comic in terms of story and in terms of the look, even that much more. So that's what I would say as a movie. Oh, sure. I liked it just as much as anybody, you know, in terms of just being a fun, you know, action filled sci-fi comic, kind of movie. But, I thought ours tried to really take the comic book and more or less bring it to life as you would see and read it on those pages. Oli made the point recently was, you know, people too will talk about the production values and whatnot, or just these boot, you know, the ones when they've seen it on a bootleg. And he says, what you got to remember too, even, well, you're seeing a bootleg, so you're seeing a generation of a generation of a generation, you know, kind of thing. But in addition, he said the print that people are seeing on that was not a finished, completed print. You know, it hadn't been color corrected and telecine'd, I think he said, it's missing a lot of elements that any finished film would normally have, right. which just, you know, certainly knock it down a few notches in terms of just visually what you're able to see on it.
Well, Richard Donner got to go back and remake Superman 2, so who knows? Maybe he'll get to go back and make. Back and remake Fantastic, clean up the effects, and a little bit in there. Maybe get a little bit in better effects on the Human Torch at the end there.
Exactly. Kind of cool. Yeah. Yeah.
But still very cool. I mean, you get to throw the flames at the end. So.
I think the one that cracks me up the most, just in terms of, you know, when you go, oh, that's kind of fun, cheesy, is at the end when the two get married and they race off in the limo, in the car. And you see the stretchy hand pop out and it's kind of wagging back and forth.
Yeah, it's just kind of like on a string. It's great stuff. And then how you get your powers, you know, you sneeze and blow up a bush that's sitting next to you. So
yeah, exactly. Well, and that's funny too when you watch. Oh, so that's a great scene when we crash land. Because we have these just really cheeseball spacesuits on. Well, basically, all this stuff is coming out of Corman's, you know, vaults, you know, his storage facilities, you know, from other movies and cheeseball movies. And so we got these cheeseball spacesuits that have these, you know, like your oxygen packs on the back that are Velcroed on. And it's just, again, it's just cheesy beyond belief kind of thing. But you know, you just go with it.
And you'd mentioned about amping up too. I mean, did you kind of look at that, your performance, and realize he's a hothead? And so I'm just going to go like, a lot of your, I mean, you've got to admit, you've got a really big energy in this movie.
Yeah. I mean, and that was like,
so counter to Reed too.
That was intentional. And that was just a choice that I made, you know, as an actor to do it that way. And Oli was, you know, not telling me not to, or, you know, seemed fine with everything. And so, yeah, that's Jay's take on, you know, on Johnny Storm. And like I said, I know there's people out there that hate it, or, you know, think, well, that's not him, or, you know, they've got him as a different kind of guy in their minds or whatever. But, you know, at the end of the day, I'm going to bring to it what I'm going to be able to bring to it and what I think is right and appropriate, and take the director's notes, and what you see is what you see.
But you brought everything. You brought everything in the kitchen sink to that one. So, hey, fans of your acting might be surprised to find you on a completely different stage now.
Yeah. Sure enough. I just, at some point,
did you give up acting completely?
No, not completely in the sense that I've shunned it or anything like that. I've always loved being an actor. And I think, too, once I got married and I started having a family, I got just more and more involved in my own faith and my own belief in God and the Bible and Jesus Christ. And I started wanting to live my life more the way that I believe the Bible would have me live it. And one of the things that started happening was just my career obviously would have to start changing, because there are so many. You know, I think we would all be fairly readily admitting that there is so much junk and garbage that gets made for television and movies these days. There probably most of the stuff that's on network television, I wouldn't want to show my kids. There's a lot of movies I've made I wouldn't want to show my kids, kind of thing. And so I realized that, you know, the kinds of movies and roles and things that I wanted to take was kind of getting a little more narrow. And I kind of thought at some point, you know, I'm going to be out of a job here, because I was turning down more of the auditions my agents were sending me than I was, you know, wanting to go out on. And so I kind of was wondering, well, where's this all going to lead? Where's this going to go? And I was asking that of the Lord even. And finally, it hit me just through a series of events. I just absolutely knew in my heart of hearts that what I wanted to do was I wanted to go into ministry. I wanted to go into full-time Bible gospel ministry, and I'm now a pastor. And so I'm a pastor in a small town, like I said, in Northern California, and just have gone just a completely different direction.
You're not the fire and brimstone type, are you?
You know what? I preach the Bible.
Did you see what I did there?
Preach God's word.
What I did there?
Look out, gang, because if I start, flames may come out of my hands. That's right.
I mean, Johnny Storm's up there as the pastor. Funny. Yeah, I don't, you know.
Maybe I'll have to show him a clip of me in the Fantastic and Born and say, look out, man, if you're not doing the right thing. No, that's
fireball's going to come at you or something.
But yeah, so that's just kind of a new avenue for me. In terms of acting.
You've been doing that for a few years now, right?
Yeah, I've been doing this I've been a pastor for the last 6 years.
I was going to say, probably since 08 or 09, somewhere around there.
Yeah, I think we moved here in 07. I had gone to seminary down in Los Angeles for about 4 years. And while I was in seminary, I was still doing acting gigs. I was just a little more selective about what I would do. I had a friend of mine who was a director, and he was directing a lot of Hallmark movies. And so he'd call me up and he knew I was in seminary, and say, hey, I got a couple of days on this Hallmark film. You want to come do it? And I was like, yeah, sure. That'd be great. And I was doing a lot of commercial work, and God was good to allow me to pay the bills with all that. So I was able to put myself through seminary. And then once I got up to here at the church I'm at, I've had at least one opportunity where friends of a friend, called me up about a Christian movie, a faith-based movie that they were making. So I went and did that for a few weeks. It wasn't a big budget one or anything. And now my fun thing that in terms of kind of, you know, thinking, well, okay, so Lord, what about all this acting stuff that I did, and where does that kind of fit in, or does it anymore? And I've already been able to see how even being an actor and the kinds of things that I did, how I've been able to translate that even to pastoring, and that actors are all about people. You want to know what makes people tick, and you want to get in the heart and minds of people when you play characters. And so there's a part of that where same thing as a pastor, you're dealing with people and you're wanting to help people and give people guidance and direction. And you have to kind of know what makes them tick to do that. And of course, just as an actor, you don't mind being up in front of people, and I love storytelling and whatnot. And there's an aspect of that that comes into preaching, where you're also telling stories. Jesus himself is a great storyteller, you know?
The master storyteller.
You look in the Bible, you see the parables and whatnot. And so I have fun with that. But I get to also I've become the local director of the school plays at our kids' school.
That's kind of a default position now, right? I mean, they've got to go to you for that, I would say.
It's great.
Yeah.
And I love it because I now get to kind of let those creative juices flow. I love theater. I love acting still. And now I get to hopefully help inspire the next generation of young actors. And my kids have been involved as well. And so I get to kind of live vicariously through them and do that and do local productions, which again, are tremendously fulfilling. So
oh, very
I don't
cool.
feel like I'm missing anything in terms of – in terms of not being directly involved in Hollywood anymore. In fact, when I was down there, I went down to L.A., like I said, a couple of months ago to do the documentary for Doomed. And it was fun because we're driving around L.A., and I think the fellas that had brought me down there were taking me back to the Burbank airport, and we saw a film. A movie on location, you know, in Burbank, you know, filming something at some strip mall there. And you know, you see the lights out and you see the camera, and it's more of a fondness towards it, where I could look at that and go, you know, I used to do that. I used to be a part of that. And what a great gig and what a great ride. And I feel totally blessed to have ever been allowed to even be involved in Hollywood or making movies. Because it's definitely not something that everybody gets to do, and it was a form of acting that I particularly enjoyed, making movies, you know, and working with a camera and whatnot. There's all the other seedy side of Hollywood and the grotesqueness of it all, and even with the Fantastic Four, some of the kind of shady, slimy, you know, backroom deals that are happening that you go, I have no use for all that, but I truly did care about a lot of the parts I played and just being involved in the industry. And I met a lot of great people, you know. And so, again, I look back on it very fondly.
Well, you've certainly given us a lot of great characters over the years, a lot of really cool genre projects, science fiction, fantasy, comic book related. You know, we can go back and take a look at those and watch them over and over again and really get the enjoyment out of them. So thank you for putting all those out there. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure. It's been fun. It's been a fun ride.
And thanks for joining us on the show today. We appreciate you taking the time to join us here today.
Love it. I've really appreciated being on Comic Book Central.
I think it's hilarious that Jay's initial reaction to the Fantastic Four was less than enthusiastic, because when you watch his performance in the film, it's the polar opposite of that. He really brought the goods in that flick. If you haven't seen it, it's on YouTube in all of its 90s glory. Jay's throwing fireballs. The Jeweler, that's right, an original Fantastic Four villain, the Jeweler. He's acting all evil and stuff. And Ben Grimm is clobbering people left and right. Oh, and speaking of the Rocky One, next week it is indeed clobbering time, as Michael Bailey Smith will be here to talk about playing the pride of Yancey Street, Ben Grimm. As you might have noticed, all my guests have been talking about the soon-to-be-released Fantastic Four documentary, Doomed, the Untold Story of Roger Corman's The Fantastic Four. Check out the trailer and learn more about the documentary at doomedthemovie.com. And be sure to check out all the cyber homes of Comic Book Central. You can like and share the lair at facebook.com/Comic Book Central Network. The website is comicbookcentral.net, where you can check out all the past episodes. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and please rate and review the show. It's certainly appreciated. Tweets and emails. Twitter feed is at comicbookctrl, and you can email me, joe@comicbookcentral.net. Next week, Fantastic Four February flies on like the Fantastic Car with Michael Bailey Smith, Ben Grimm. Oh, I hope he doesn't smash up the lair. Until then, keep reading those comics, and thanks for joining me here in the lair, Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. This podcast is intended for entertainment and education purposes only. All original content of this podcast is the intellectual property of Comic Book Central and is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivations 3.0 Unported License. All other content and names are registered trademarks and copyrights of their respective holders.
Golly, comic books are larger than life. I mean, are they?